Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Mark Archer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. We've come to talk about your documentary, Don't Go Gentle, a film about idols, haven't we?
I guess. I'm here for whatever questions you want to ask.
Well, I'm going to focus on that. If you decide you want to talk about something else, I'll have to follow you, but I'm not ready for that bit yet. So before we go into details then, I mean, it's bleeding obvious from the title, but do you want to give us what your brief synopsis is about this documentary?
Yeah, so the film obviously, it captures their rise. The reason I started the film was because they were a bunch of Bristol lads who'd done good. They'd hit some problems personally. And when they just started breaking into London, I thought that was just an inspiring story enough to roll with it. But the film kind of turned into something a lot more. I mean, originally back then it was a short film. So the film goes and it kind of rides the wave, the wave that they hit, but also the domino effect it had on their community of fans, who sort of opened up the whole topic of mental health. And
well, let's get into that. I mean, essentially it's a rock documentary, but it's a rock documentary with bells and whistles on, because it focuses on the people that follow the band. It focuses on the band and the tribulations of being in a band, the struggles, the family ties, the family pressures. And obviously grief is a big thing that features quite high in the narrative of this.
And it's raw.
Yeah, indeed. That's one of the, and we'll talk about how you tackle that. So you say you started off with a short film. So did a short film get made and released, or did you start making a short film and it just mushroomed into a feature?
No, that was how I think I got their manager to agree to me doing something, because it was like, I just got this short film idea. I'd shot a short film before, but it never released. And so I was like, can I just join you? I've got this little idea. He said, yeah, sure. And then I just kept, this is when they weren't big at the time. I'd just seen something in the band that I wanted to tell that story. And as they snowballed, I just kept filming. I just kept turning up to gigs, turning up at things that they were doing. And there was a point where it was like, Mark, like, what are you doing? What are you making?
Right, okay.
Yeah, and I kind of said, I've got no idea what I'm making. Went away, thought about it, and that's kind of when it became bigger. It became a feature idea at that point.
What, in the sense that you were purposely making a feature-length documentary?
Yeah, there was a conversation. I met Lindsay Melbourne, who's one of the producers on the film, but also an amazing photographer. Mm. And I'd approached Lindsay to use her photographs in the short film. And at that point, we met in a pub in, I think it was in New Cross in London. Mm. And she we got talking, and she said, "Have you heard of the Afghan, you know, the fan group?" And they were like 30 people on Facebook. It wasn't, I hadn't heard of them. I had no idea. And she was like, you might want to look at this for the film. Mm. And then as soon as we started looking at that, and as soon as we started seeing idols sort of, it's not in the film, but they got Foo Fighters, you know, picked them to support them at the O2. Like, just mad things were happening. Mm. Jules Holland was around that time. You know, things were just going off. And when that, alongside the, what was going on with the fan community, it was like, okay, maybe we should, let's just drop all worries and concerns we had. And I think their manager, you know, I showed him a bit of a treatment that I did, like I pulled together, and he said, "You can make it, but as long as it's fucking good." And I was like,
okay,
I don't know if it's going to be that good,
yeah.
But I'll give it a shot. And so we just thought, yeah, we'll drop everything and go for it. So that's what we did.
So in that sense, the band weren't having creative control of the documentary then?
So amazingly, when we did the sort of the long sit down chat with Joe, when we filmed for the filming, he said at the end, "I will have as much or as little creative control as you want in this film. I don't need any, it's yours. This is your creative journey. So use me if you want me, but I'm like, this is yours."
Mm.
So yeah, it's kind of been all our creation, and the band just let me in, which was amazing.
Yeah. I guess it's that, I mean, it marries up with the kind of people that you portray in the film.
Mm.
Because that feels like a very truthful way for them to approach a documentary about themselves.
Yeah. Because I guess, you know, there is a separation between the film and the band. What I mean by that is they haven't had any input in it. They've let this grow by itself.
Mm.
And they've let us work. And they've just been like, oh, like there's a UK cinema run. Oh, that's cool. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
that little involvement.
Yeah. So it's all been from afar, and it's kind of, you know, I've known them for a long time now. John, especially the drummer, we went to school together.
Okay.
So it's been a very weird relationship in terms of when I see John over the last 4 years, we rarely speak about the film. The film's just been so separated from my personal relationship with him and them. And like I said, they kind of just let me go to work on it. And I would just pick dates that I thought would be good to capture for the film, points along the way. And that was that, really. About 4 years later and we're done.
So with that in mind then, I mean, obviously going to see them perform and in various places and significant events, there's still the process of getting the essential talking heads and stuff, so you get an appropriate narrative from the band of what you're trying to say as much as what is actually happening says for itself. Were you shaping a narrative while interviewing, or was the narrative shaping what you do next time you turn up?
No, we like I said before, I filmed quite a lot with them.
Mm.
Just I turned up and filmed gigs that I wanted to film. I feel like I needed to let the story unfold more because we were filming as they were, as the band were growing and as the group were growing. So we just kept filming. At that point, I thought it was loose. It was like, let's see where this goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we chose our sort of points that we would host these chats quite well, in terms of it was kind of in the middle of their sort of overnight success, if you want to put it like that.
Yeah.
So it was almost like they weren't media trained yet. if you would call them that now, I don't know, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, and you can be media savvy even if you're not, if just by the nature of having done a lot of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we'd hit them at that time when maybe they hadn't. Joe had, I think, because it would only really be Joe that was doing the interviews at the beginning.
Always the lead singer.
Yeah, 100%. It wouldn't be anyone else, right?
I've been there. I've tried to speak to other band members. They just won't even talk to you half the time.
Yeah, well, this was it, yeah. So we were at the beginning when we'd set up the chats with Joe. It was almost chatting to them one by one. Because I know Lee, one of the guitarists, was like, I don't want, you know, you just do the film, you know, talk to Joe, you know, you don't need us. And it was like, I was filming them in Dublin. They were supporting Future Islands.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the stadium, but it was like their first stadium show.
Okay.
And they were supporting Future Islands, but there wasn't like a ton of people there. And I just remember thinking, crap, this is a really bad gig to choose to come and film them. But then my sister Sarah, she got on board with the film and helped me sort of, I think, create that narrative at the beginning.
Mm.
She's one of the producers as well. She was like, Mark, it's the perfect place to film them. When there's the, because what you'll see in the footage, we don't really dive into it too much, but there's not a big crowd, but they give 110%.
Mm.
And I remember them chatting backstage, and it was annoying because I don't think I was wrong on the camera at the time. They said, listen, let's go out, give absolutely everything.
Mm.
And like, because they'd acknowledged that there was no crowd, so it was tough. But that's just in their nature.
While you were in Ireland playing, Lee began to take what you're doing more seriously than before, in the sense of he could sense there was more than just a guy filming a band on the road.
Yeah, I think so, because it was the fact that, why is this guy coming all the way to Dublin?
Mm.
Filming us play a bit of a no-show, in terms of it wasn't their show, they're supporting, there wasn't a big crowd or whatever. So I think it just started, maybe for all of them at that point, they were just like, oh, okay, he's actually making a documentary now. It was different to the fun and games we were having before. So I guess it was good for me then to spend time with them, which I hadn't really done before.
Okay.
As in, you know, just hang out backstage and be with them, and there's no one else. They're not doing any interviews. It was time for me to like embed myself a little bit, and so they got comfortable.
Mm.
I think that happened that weekend. But yeah, it was good, and I got to see Future Islands play, which was great.
I imagine so. and there you tackle a lot of different narratives in the thing, least of all. Each band member themselves could tell a story. So, and Lee in particular, you could have gone off and told Lee's story as a kind of B film almost, couldn't you? I think I get the sense of. I mean, you tell us enough in the context of him joining the band and stuff, but
yeah, I think it was the case that you can't tell every story, and we touch upon it in the film in the sense of. What Lee brought to that band wasn't just music. It was a turning point in Lee's life to move on from his addiction was, I think, for him to commit to the band, it kickstarted, it almost reignited their faith in themselves.
Mm.
And that was the point. I mean, like you say, Lee's, I'm sure Lee will talk about it at depth, and I think he has a little bit already, but it wasn't really the time. It wasn't, you know, you don't take every opportunity there is to if it doesn't really make sense to the story. That I didn't want to abuse that. They'd let me in.
No, and that the question to follow that is how, when you're in the midst of making a film where there are these interesting other stories that are in the sphere of what you're telling, but aren't necessarily what you need to be telling. How do you keep a sort of an eye on your bigger picture, as it were?
It's really difficult. It's really difficult, and I think I had to understand that I'm not an experienced filmmaker.
Okay.
I have a background in TV. I studied film at uni. I don't think make you a filmmaker. You've got to, you know, I knew enough, but I think it was also talking and getting advice from
other filmmakers.
Okay.
So
who did you speak to?
For example, Christine Franz, who did Bunch of Cunts, The Sleep of Modstock.
Oh, right. Okay. Brilliant documentary.
Amazing film. She's an amazing woman. And I remember when I started this film, I was in a company and actually it was a guy who was a bit of a mentor to me at the time said, go speak to someone like Christine. Because it was such a DIY, you know, that sort of punk ethos within the film. It'll be a good chat, whatever the chat is. Mm. And so over the last few years, me and Christine sort of, it's probably only speak about once every 6 months, but it was so reassuring for me to speak to her about her experiences, which I was going through very similar experiences that she'd been through. Mm. So it wasn't a case of asking her creatively, what do I do here? It was more like, you can do this.
No, I'm sure that's part of it. Cause in a way, if you're making a fictional film where you've got a shot list for the day and you've got actors on set, you know what finished looks like. Whereas if you turn up to a gig in Bristol or in Leeds to cover the band, you're just there to get what you can get. And if something emerges fantastic, because over 4 years, you're going to have a lot of stuff a lot more on the cutting room floor than you will on screen, won't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I think what we did, what I also sort of decided I didn't want to do was go to the music award shows or cover too many, you know, like I mentioned the Foo Fighters gig earlier. Mm. I didn't really want to cover that. I didn't really want to cover the, you know, whatever, like Jules Holland, for example.
Yeah.
Given I did try and get access to Jules Holland, didn't happen.
Right.
But I don't know if it would have made it in the final cut, because it's kind of taking away from the attention of what the actual film's about. So it was chats with the likes of Christine, but were just really reassuring into, you know, I remember her telling me once, keep the blinkers on. Don't, because you're going to have a lot of people giving you different bits of, you know, you steer this way, you want this, you want this. And yeah, she was like, absolutely right. That was the case. And in the end, especially with the final edit, it was me and my editor, but it was basically me in an Airbnb over lockdown, the first one, finishing it up.
Mm.
And it was, I just felt like it was like the last man standing type thing. And so, yeah, she was right. And in the end, I guess I battled with confidence throughout it, but in the end, I just needed to get it done.
As much as it's a document of idols, it's also a film. So how were you managing to keep your eye on the aesthetic and keeping it visually interesting at the same time? You know, there's one thing to set a camera up and go, hey, Joe, this question, there's another question. Mm. But there's another thing then to have something interesting to look at while that's all coming across.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it was a case that there was always something exciting going on across that time period that was happening, especially with the fans. I feel like the injection that we put into the film, when we embraced the Afghan community and we're like, this is part of the film, it's a story that's going to run parallel to the bands. And we're gonna just continue filming with them and ride that wave together, and we'll just see how this turns out type thing. Mm. That was the energy for me, because, like, you know, there's a lot of films about bands and I couldn't make a glossy movie about, you know, a band hitting. I couldn't do that. But with the fans, I felt like I am one of them. Like, and so when we had their energy to feed off, and I guess it wasn't a problem, but like, there were so many fans telling us their stories. It was almost impossible to pick one. It was a case of like trying to paint the bigger picture of this community through maybe two or three different stories within it.
Mm.
Because there are too many to tell in one film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, because so AFGANG is the online community for fans of idols formed by Lindsay Melbourne, yeah? And it was, like you said at the start, it evolved out of a Facebook group. And what did you say? There was 30 people when you first...
I think when Lindsay, when I first started speaking with Lindsay, there was about 26 people.
So now there's 30,000 plus.
There's over 30,000, yeah. Easy.
That's amazing.
Which is insane. And Lindsay's been around sort of music all her life, and she was part of the Libertines fan group, and she was, you know, on the road with them. And I think she just clocked it early. She clocked what was happening. She clocked that Joe was talking about, it wasn't just about the songs either, which he does talk about all these themes, but it was in between the songs. It was the stuff he was saying to the crowd, to their faces, about like, don't be too aggressive, look after yourself. You know, all these little comments started seeping through, and she could see people at the gigs as, you know, that changed things. And it was something unique that she hadn't seen for a long time. And so, to be honest with you, yeah, I'm really glad I dropped her a line to meet at that pub.
Yeah.
Because she kind of changed the direction of the film in terms of its ambition and what it would be too.
Okay. Were you conscious of that from that conversation, or is that in hindsight?
No, from that conversation, as soon as she said some of the conversations she'd been having with people, because to be honest with you, I'm not one of those to have those conversations with people after, like, I'd sometimes like to dip in and dip, like, observe and get out. That's sort of in my nature. Whereas Lindsay was having these conversations with people after the gigs about their lives, and it was something would happen where the person she would be talking to, as well as herself, you'd just skip the there would be no sort of niceties. It would be talking about life straight away. How are you? Are you okay? and as soon as she started telling me some of the stories, I was like, damn, well, yeah, let's go. So me and Lindsay went on the road, and we spent quite a few months, you know, dipping in and out of different cities and meeting with the fans and getting their stories. And, you know, not everyone's story could be told in the film, but there'll be another time for those stories to come, you know?
Yeah, I guess. And again, that represents its own, like, another challenge for you as the filmmaker to keep a lid on, or keep your blinkers on, as you're advised, in terms of what you are trying to tell.
You know, it is, it's hard. I almost got to the point where you want choice in the edit, right? Mm-hmm. You want choice to be able to play with, because some things might not work. When you think on the day you film something amazing, maybe 8 times out of 10, it doesn't work. I don't know. Mm. So, but these people were trusting me, an unknown human, with their most personal stories. And to be honest, that was the biggest takeaway for me, was that people did that. And I didn't want to abuse that too much. So we filmed and we recorded with quite a lot of them, but I couldn't speak to everyone. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, of course. But when you're having these ongoing conversations with people, and obviously you suddenly become a fixture of the band's sort of presence when they're about, because, like you said, the momentum that idols seem to gather is that very natural thing. And it's interesting that you spoke to the director of the Sleaford Mods documentary, because I think in some senses it's a very similar trajectory in that it was a very local story that then got the attention of the London media, in inverted commas, which then become a natural national story in terms of music fans. I mean, it's not everybody knows about them, but certainly, you know, you get on Jules Holland, that's a wide audience in terms of music fans.
Well, I guess they just kept, there was a point where, and you know, someone who features in the film is Steve Lamacq. And it was almost comical how passionate Steve got about idols. because he would mention them on like every show for years before they cracked it, which I don't even know what that means anymore, but before got bigger, started playing bigger shows, he would be playing them for years. And so we did film with him. He was the one guy that we thought, if we're going to film with one person, like not no producers, no ultra famous faces, like someone who was just, you know, the great support of like the underdog in general too. And Steve was that guy, because everyone takes credit, you know, a certain amount of credit, but I don't think Idols would be anywhere near where they are now without him, you know? He was pivotal, and that's why he's in the film, and that's why we give him his like moment to tell his pretty funny Idols interaction.
Well, it's always good that it's like all these things are very much they could have gone either way in terms of the magic moment when it happens, because life is that flipping, isn't it? Life isn't always about major plans. It's about, and the magic of a band is that you catch them and you feel like you've caught something amazing.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it was I think...
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What people don't appreciate is how long they were together before they got their shit together, really. Like, you know, it was seven years or so where they just couldn't find their identity, or maybe they were building towards it, you know.
I mean, all decent bands worth anything of their salt tend to be a 5 to 10 year overnight sensation, don't they? I mean, it's kind of like the reason they're good is because they've been doing it a while, not because they're good.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
What I was going to say when I was rattling on with myself was how did your interviewing get easier or harder as they become more interviewed by the media at large? Because obviously, if they're growing, that means more people want their attention. At the start, you'd have been fighting off student magazines and fanzines, and maybe the odd music mag. Then you're going to be. Then you've got the national, international media that want a piece of it as well, and you're there sticking your camera in the face.
So yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because there were moments that I was trying to get to film, and like I said with the Jules Holland, that was just one of the examples. But there were other moments where it was like you just can't come. I think they were doing, it was either Six Music Live Lounge or maybe the Radio 1 Live Lounge or something. I was trying to get in there, and they were just like too many people. And I got that towards the end of the time I spent filming with them. It was more and more like, there's just, you can't, you can't get in here. In terms of the interviews, I guess it's a bit different because, so the setup that we had on the road was because we didn't have like a cameraman, like as such. It was like, I was shooting a lot of it. You know, and I can shoot, but I wouldn't call myself a cameraman, you know. So my, like, we got the for this interview setups, we got the kit from my sister's company that she was working at the time. They lent it to us, they would let her and one of her colleagues, who's a sound man, who's probably more of a cameraman than I am, come with the kit, and we would set up, and between the three of us, you know, I would be chatting with my sister or Lindsay, whoever was coming on the road, because I would be on the camera. One of them would be hosting the interviews a lot of the time. Sometimes I did it by myself when it was like messy, But my sister and me, we've known the band forever. So it was kind of like, as long as we sat with them long enough, after about 2 minutes, you'd get the less professional answer.
Got you.
It would be more relaxed, mainly because we had that relationship with them before. So it felt quite personal straight off the bat.
Now, obviously, in hindsight, it's very truthful to the band, because of the way that they sort of address mental health in their lyrics, the formation of the Afghang and what they say about the band and what the band say to them. But you've got two or three instances of death in families that happen while you're making this film that you give time to let them talk about it, or they want to talk about it, one or the other. I'd be interested to see what your advice is really about, because I mean you've got the history with the band, so you're not just somebody coming in cold saying, tell me about how sad you're feeling, kind of thing. You're not. Mm. It's not opportunistic. This is what's happening while you're making your film. But what's your advice to a filmmaker, you know, faced with that kind of very real, raw story that's fast emerging alongside this fantastical story of a band on the rise?
Yeah, I guess you've got to have your moral compass pointing the right way.
Yeah.
I remember chatting with Joe and just saying, we won't ever tell this in an untruth, like we won't ever mold this into something else other than what it is.
Mm.
Because the other thing, and there was a reason to tell it. There was a reason to tell those stories, in that Joe didn't come saying, oh, tell this story, tell that story. It wasn't that. The reason for people that knew Idols when they were coming up, part of the reason, you know, he spoke about it in interviews around the time, that was more the reason as to why people were responding to them.
Yes.
People would relate. And I think it's that basic thing of when you talk about something, someone will be listening. And I think there was maybe a moment of realization for that from the band, in that they could help people by speaking about it, not just on stage, but off. I mean, there's a beautiful song called June on Joy as an Act of Resistance on their second album, which is about the death of his stillborn, Agatha. I didn't feel the need to put that in the film. You know, people would say, at that moment, because we tell that story, I didn't feel like it was necessary. There wasn't a reason to put it in, other than make you bawl your freaking eyes out.
Yeah,
there was no, and that's not a reason. That's not a, you know. So there was that respect, and that, I guess, between us, and that trust that we wouldn't go to that place if the opportunity arose. We wouldn't go there. We would tell the story as it is. I had an experience actually on this short film that was unreleased a few years ago, and it was about this boxing gym in Wandsworth in London.
Right.
And it was the most sort of bizarre experience, and it relates to this, how I think I could get Joe's trust and the band's trust as well. Not they didn't know this, but she had a horrific sort of personal loss, and I had nothing. I just went with the camera, and I was just like, I found out about her story from going to the boxing gym, and she just said, you can like tell it as long as you tell it truthfully. And I just had this amazing sort of like a year or so where I just kept going to this boxing gym, and we would chat, and she would just let me in.
Mm.
And so I think I gained a lot from that, in that, you know, your film is never going to be bigger than someone's life or someone's story.
Yeah.
So when someone does let you in, that's a responsibility in a way that you've got to really value and respect. And, you know, there was another moment in the Idols film where we've got, we've got something that Joe says on film that it would have destroyed everyone type thing, but it wasn't necessary for the story of the film. So, you know, I think it's that balance, yeah, that balance of finding the truth without, you don't have to reveal everything to, you know, you don't have to put everything out there. You don't have to, you get that emotion from.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I didn't feel watching the film was lacking any nuance about how tragic it is to lose your child. I mean, the film tells you, yeah, you know, and obviously it's in the context of what is a rock documentary. So it's like, this is what it look. What we're seeing is what it looks like in the life of a rock band. Not like that. That's, yeah, particularly special or unique in terms of, but because it becomes a universal truth, doesn't it? Then it's like suddenly it's just a fella, yeah, who would have been a father had that child survived, yeah, kind of thing. And that's not that's not rock band specific at all. It's just human.
No, and I guess the fairly interesting thing about that period of filming was, the filming at Alexandra Palace was about 3 weeks after Agatha's death. But I'd chosen that date prior to knowing about it as the first day I wanted to film with them as they were finally getting somewhere in London. And that was like my full story for the short film.
Mm.
So I'd picked that date, and I don't think I found out until that day that had happened. So that was the first day. And so it's right. It's, you know, it was, I think that was a weird beginning for my journey with the band. It kind of glued me in quite early on because I was just around at that time.
Yeah. I mean, all, but from a kind of, I mean, I would only class myself as, you know, given the presence of the Afghang. I mean, I'm essentially idle curious in comparison. And while I love the song Mother, I didn't realize this. I mean, and it's powerful and the message is clear, but I hadn't realized how powerful it was and how much of a celebration it was of someone's life. As much as
until you watch the film.
Yeah. Or, yeah. The song was just in a song on the album and I enjoyed the chorus and it felt powerful. Funny, to me, but then it's now since watching the film, it's now got an absolutely heightened meaning to it. In fact, weirdly, the joy of the song for me originally was just, you know, read and make money and you can kill a Tory. And that always entertained me.
But that always works.
But now I'm thinking more of who the protagonist of the story is in that song, and it's his mother, and I think that's really powerful.
I think that's it. And like that song in particular, I think it's got to be my favorite track, probably.
Mm.
It just hits so many sort of it's so many core themes that I don't know that speaks to me personally, but. Yeah, that it was so powerful, and that was another example of Joe letting us have the creative freedom, because he said, "I've got this VHS tape up in the attic." Because I said, "Have you got any footage of your mum?" You know, and he said, "I've got this tape," and then he pretty much just sent it to us, so that you can use what you want on it, whatever's on it, use it. I think. So, yeah, I feel like we had that separation, but also that creative freedom to do what we like. So that, you know, it was amazing to actually put a face, you know, to that story, because that's just I think everyone can relate somewhat, you know.
No, without a doubt.
And then
going back to sort of the sort of ascendancy of the band, what's interesting, and this is, I'm obsessed with the idea of how people in the creative industries sort of chisel out their little avenue. Not everybody can be U2 or Picasso, but we can certainly be, you know, the Idols and somebody else who's not as famous as Picasso. but one of the things that's clear when you're watching the ascendancy of the band is that, A, it takes time, but also one thing that I've learned from other people I've had advice from is patience and consistency also play a crucial part in what becomes that success down the road. Mm. It's like, it's not like you were going, and the band were once like this, and then they were like that. Then the nature of what they were was growing from that first seed. It was just like you said earlier on, it was more like they didn't quite know what it was, but they kind of had a sense of where it was going. So they just kept almost like, I mean, I'm putting this on the film now and on the band, but it certainly felt like, right. It certainly felt like there's a belief. And I guess you've got to be somehow deluded in a healthy sense to want to pursue something where the outcome isn't, oh, you're very good here. Here's a check. Because you've got all the other variables, including Joe Public, that's going to decide whether or not you get a check of any description.
I think that there was a line in the film that did it for me. And it was, I think Joe says something like, you know, it was when the first album had just come out and he was doing a radio interview and he just goes, listen, we're like an 8 out of 10 band at the moment. And that's fine. Mm. We'll get, you know, we'll keep going. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, that's what we are right now. It's like, and I think Joe is that person maybe still, like, who drove that, the belief. It really came through Joe, like, you know, because there were plenty of times where they were just drunk on stage or, you know, messing up. It wasn't, and I think that is that. I don't know whether it's a geographical thing as well from Bristol, as in, like, coming for a city where there's not a ton of bands that make it out of Bristol. Mm. The scene's amazing. It's it's great, but not a ton of bands hit maybe the height, the larger heights, whatever that is. Mm. And I think they really did believe in that. And I think part of the thing that drew me to them as well was their age, because they weren't 21-year-old kids when they started with a band. They were maybe in their mid to late 20s, but then by the time they were maybe just scratching the surface in their, like, mid early 30s. So it was like, these are guys that aren't giving up. Mm. They're not gonna take no as an answer.
Yeah.
I think that just inspired me, just as, like, a message to anyone.
I mean, again, there's parallels with Sleaf of Mods, isn't it? It's like the idea of having lived a life as well as created a band is quite a foundation that's not to underestimate it. And also, it's not about being, it isn't about the ambition to suddenly be U2. It's actually, if you can make this machine work. I mean, one of my favorite bands is The Fall, and famously he had an album out called 50,000 Fall Fans Can't Be Wrong. So it's like, he was never trying to be U2, but as long as he serviced 50,000 fans, it was a going concern that is a rare thing in any creative industry.
Yeah, 100%. And I saw Idols support The Fall.
Oh, really?
I can't even remember the year, but it was a long time ago. And he was hilarious. Marky Smith was hilarious. Like, because I remember Dev was saying, this is like one of their idols too.
I imagine.
And I think they were all super nervous to be around him, super, like, cautious, didn't want to piss him off too much or whatever. Mm. And I remember Dev was telling us a story that while Marky Smith was playing, Dev was just having a cigarette outside, like, what a crazy night, this is mad, just like by himself. And then Marky Smith, whilst the gig is playing, just burst through the back door. He's like, all right, man. Dev's like, are you not meant to be on stage, like, right now? and he just had enough. He just had one of those nights where he'd had enough of, you know, playing. So he just, I think he had shared a cigarette with Dev or something. That was that. But
to Marky Smith's book launch and he didn't turn up for his own book launch.
Yeah.
He was so happy in the pub, he just thought he couldn't be asked, apparently.
But isn't that ethos kind of refreshing, man? It's so nice. I feel like maybe not everyone can do that. But I think maybe they took something from that night, in that they just got to pave your own path.
Yeah.
Because because the other thing is you don't want to live a life that, how valuable can your life be if you're not being true and to yourself, at least?
No. So if all you do is please everybody, you're never going to please yourself.
Yeah.
And that's not to say you have to be an arrogant prick, but
no.
But there comes a point. Well,
they can be sometimes.
Well, you wouldn't be in a band if you weren't, to some degree. Comes with the territory, because there isn't like some electric shock you get and then you're ready to go on stage. there's still a human emotion. I mean, I've managed the band in the past, and it's sort of, you know, the personalities and stuff. It's what I learned through working with a band is it's, whereas when you know them as a band on stage, they look amazing. Then you get to know the people and they're still brilliant people. But you realize there's four different personalities who are getting ready to go on stage. And that's like four people getting ready to go to work.
Yeah, 100%. And they've all got their own different, you know, tactics to G themselves up. And, you know, I guess one of the Bowen, who's the Irishman, who used to be a dentist, who plays a lot in his pants. Yeah. He probably won't do much anymore. I think he's had enough of it. But he's pretty shy, like off stage. He's one of those, he comes like, he really feels it on stage. He almost like channels his dreams or whatever it is, and he lets it out. But yeah, I think that was one of the things with Idols is it took them a lot, quite some time naturally to all find their own elements that they could bring to the band and make that gel. Because I think that's just an ongoing thing. Like, you know, with their last album, they're finding musically where they can give each other breaks and allow themselves to express themselves and or hold them back. John, like the drummer, I know that sometimes they like to hold him back and then maybe, you know, unleash him sometimes. But they're learning that as they go. They're not, you know, and you can hear it in their albums, which is a kind of a really cool thing.
No, totally. And I think in a way I saw a similar sort of trajectory with sort of bands that arrived ready formed. I mean, it just as in they were experienced, they weren't wet behind the ears. Like you think of like how when the White Stripes broke, there was two albums sort of already in the can. So they knew what they wanted to do, but then you see how that music changes as they become more assured and stuff. Or even like the direction the Arctic Monkeys have gone into now. It's like it's unrecognizable from where they were, but still them. It's still the Arctic Monkeys. So I think it's great that they can find that between each other. let's remind people then, when can they see your film?
So they can, well, it's out in cinemas. You'll be able to get tickets from the 23rd of June, previews. 2nd of July is the cinema release date across the UK. And then it'll be online or physical. Will be out on the 6th of August. Is that right, Stuart?
It is, yes, 6th of August. You're doing well.
Yeah.
Now, one last question before we sign off. You said that John's your friend from going back when.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously doing a documentary about John being a band that John's in.
Yeah.
What would you say you learned about your friend that you didn't know before?
Honestly, nothing.
Seriously?
Absolutely. There was nothing. Because I think maybe what I learned from it was that he has kept his feet entirely rooted on the ground.
Yeah.
Like, we were in the making of the film, we'd never speak about it. I remember for the Foo Fighters gig, basically, I have this thing where apart from occasionally when I would film them for their dates, I would always pay for a ticket. I would never ask for a guest list or anything from the early days to like now. So I kind of regretted it on the Foo Fighters gig though, because that was like 70 quid. So I feel like, a bit too much. But in terms of John, me and him it's been the same relationship since we were kids. And he's just got his feet on the ground everywhere. He's just a nice guy. It's really irritating, actually. He's just a nice guy.
Well, let me flip it back around then on you. You at the start, you said you didn't know what you were really getting yourself into, and it mushroomed into this feature film. So having made the feature film and now basking in its glory of having done it, what could you say that you've found out about yourself that you didn't know?
It's tricky. I grew a lot in terms of just internally throughout this whole process.
Yeah.
And I made a ton of mistakes probably and didn't deal with everything the way I should have done and stuff like that. But I think looking back on it, I mean, I'm amazed that we've got it finished and done, to be honest with you, because, you know, there's been making a DIY film like this. We didn't really get any external finance or anything like that. So it was really DIY. It was tough. You know, I like I took time off my TV sort of side of things, and I worked with my mate who's a builder, and actually freaking, although I can't lift crap, I actually really enjoyed the process, but I realized that I would just do anything to get it done at that point. I'll just, whatever will get the film done, I'll get it done. So I guess that that determination that sometimes you do, it's funny, I watched a film and it's really annoying because I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But I think it's the director who made Drive and works with Ryan Gosling a lot.
And Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yeah.
The one his wife made while he was doing Only God Forgives.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That film, I remember I was going through this phase of being like, oh, screw everything. Like, what's the point? No one cares. You know, I was being all self-pitiful and, and stuff like that. And and the editor, Tom, that worked on the film, he was like, watch this film. Just watch it. And that's some good advice I could give to anyone, actually. Like, watch that film, because he's an unbelievable filmmaker. And you just see, we all talk the same crap, no matter what level you're on.
Yeah,
we're all going to bed feeling, what's the point? There's, you know, no one cares about this thing. If I stop now, it won't ever get finished. Blah, blah, blah. You know, you get over yourself. And at the end of the day, it was a lovely thing that the wife had made it as well, because my partner lived through this whole process too. So I also learned that my partner can deal with a lot of crap as well as me, you know, hearing me talk rubbish about it every day. But it's one of those things that I couldn't be happier that it's done. It's still surreal that it's going to hit the cinema. It's mad that people are going to watch it. And I just hope people enjoy it.
Well, look, Mark, I'm glad you made it. I'm glad you told yourself to keep going. It was a joy to watch. So thank you for that. And thank you very much for giving your time on the BritFlix podcast.
No worries. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.